I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast with Benji Nice and Milano Sanremo Recap Podcast. We've just watched them descend off the Poggio. The animal thing is back in the corner of Benji's screen. He's obviously very excited about it, whatever it's called. Before we get into the recap, I want to give a big shout out to our show partner, LeCol, www.lecol. LeCol put up a pretty honest campaign. Obviously, in Europe, you're allegedly going into spring and summer. Well, not allegedly. Milano Sanremo, judging from the photos you'll see on the screen, it's pretty good weather. But LeCol did like a full photo shoot with like pop-up screens behind in different locations. Obviously, normally they go to various locations to take photos, and they didn't want to during COVID, obviously. So that's pretty cool. If you want to see more of that, it's on their Instagram, as well as some of the new kit they've released, the best performance cycling apparel on the market. But you know Milano Sanremo, 300Ks, long climb in the middle that doesn't do anything. It kicks off with the Cipressa, then the Poggio, where it's all decided, then 4Ks descent into the finish. There was a break. It was kept in check. Tim de Klerk paced, and I'll throw to Benji with like 50Ks to go or so in a Buhani tantrum.
Yeah, Buhani had a bit of a moment today. He was feeling like he wanted to have some attention. And actually, a teammate of his from Arkea made a bit of a steering mistake, I think. Ended up crashing both himself and Buhani. And Buhani had none of it. He got pretty angry and worked up about it. And while standing up, he pulled his bike basically into his own teammate angrily, probably shouted at him in the meanwhile because the other guy looked like he was scared for his life. And Buhani just took his bike and rode away. So a bit of a tantrum against his own teammate. If I was that teammate, I would never want to ride for Buhani ever again. That was, yeah, that's disrespectful, and definitely if it's one of your own team riders. But luckily, as karma, he was not really part of the race afterwards, so I'm pretty happy about that personally. Anyway, I think the next thing that happened was a bit of a puncture by an important rider for a bunch of people. We had him signed off already for this race because we didn't really feel like he was going to make it over both the Cipressa and the Poggio in the front group, and that was Sam Bennett. And, well, we don't know now if he would have gotten over the Poggio, but I don't think so. And
it's like Koos with the time trialing, Benji.
Yes.
He's just never tried. He's just never had the opportunity.
It's really true. That's the worst part. Now, Bennett, his puncture, brought him to behind the peloton for the change. And nobody was sent to bring him back from the Koenig. So the Koenig clearly had a plan to go for Alaphilippe and Balbini here. Bennett was not in the picture for this, and that was clear by the fact that nobody was used to help him get back up. Now, he did get back up before the Cipressa, but spent a lot of energy and was behind the peloton for quite a bit. And we noticed that when he got to the back, then suddenly de Koenig was there with Stibar to bring him back to the front. So he was perhaps a bit of a third person they had in the team, just in case he was still there if everything turned out for a sprint or something, but they didn't want to put all the eggs in his basket, which is good, looking at the rest of the stage. And in the first place, I didn't really have much cards on Bennett himself, but who was it that opened up on the Cipressa? I think nobody really, but Jumbo started pacing, right? Yes.
Yeah. Well, Jumbo, I mean, we criticize them, I think, for having not the strongest team. I still think that's a justified criticism after today. But yeah, it was tailwind apparently, Benji, for a lot of today. They were ahead of schedule. De Klerk had pulled off. No one really wanted to take it up on Cipressa. So Jumbo-Visma started pacing pretty hard with Timo Roosen, one of the last riders for Jumbo-Visma, keeping him right in second wheel on the Cipressa. And this is with over 20Ks to go. This is with 27Ks to go. or so. They've basically caught the break. Norsgaard and Cove come back in dribs and drabs. Tucker van der Horn's about to get caught. MVDP's out of position going into the Chipressa. He'd be moving up and back, up and back, up and back. He'd get to the front of the group and then, like a washing machine effect, get 2 minutes later, spat, and you'd be look, and oh, is it him? No, it's Jenny. It's MVDP is actually 50th wheel. And yeah, Roosen pulled off with 24.5 Ks to go. Sam Ooman appeared out of nowhere for Jumbo Visma and started driving it again. And I don't think it was the hardest pace in the world. I mean, you're not going to drop people in good condition on the Chipressa no matter how hard you pull. Luke Rowe was there with the Ineos train behind. Do you know why Jumbo Visma did that, Benji? Burning Roosen and Ooman on the Chipressa rather than saving them?
I think it's actually not a bad idea. We know that on the Poggio, the positioning is important and you won't have 3 or 4 teammates at the front of the peloton in any proper moment there. And when people launch on the Poggio, Van Aert will have to respond himself. Timo Rosen ain't going to do it for him. So I think the only place where the team of Van Aert could really help him here was before the Poggio. And Chipressa is part of that. I think they tried to set a tempo that is not hard, but hard enough to prevent people from wanting to attack, because we saw that Nibali was coming to the front, seeing if anybody else would make a move. Wellens was also kind of looking and and speaking through if somebody would make a move. And both Jumbo's move and after Ormond got off the front, I think Ineos took over just before the top.
Lucroy, yeah.
Those two teams made sure that nobody really made a move on the Chipressa. And I think that closed the race for that portion. But I do think that we saw something interesting going ahead on top of the Chipressa, and that's Ineos taking over and Rowe smashing it in the descent. Not a godlike tempo, but also the tempo that keeps the entire peloton on a single line. And then when you come to the bottom, he goes an extra few watts for like a kilometer or a kilometer and a half, making sure that the people that are at the back have to push so much to get back to the front of the group. And that moment, splits can happen, and they did, didn't they? I think we had two pelotons at that moment.
Yep. So Arnaud Démare on Chipressa had moved up to fourth wheel out of nowhere. The man who I've got a video in draft, and the title is "What's Going On with Arnaud Démare?" because of Paris-Nice and Tour de la Provence. And it, well, spoiler: Démare didn't win today, but he appeared in fourth wheel and. Yeah, good positioning. Luke Rowe did split it. I don't know whether it was on the descent, someone lost the wheel or not. I'm surprised the split didn't happen earlier. If Wellens was like fifth wheel for Lotto Soudal, if he lost that wheel, would have been big trouble. And then we saw MVDP and Bennett at the back of A group. We didn't know immediately which group they were in. Ewan was in group two. Luke Rowe's pacing like a madman. He's got Dylan van Baarle behind him, Pidcock and Kwiatkowski there. No Puccio, no Ganna that we could see. And yeah, MVDP Benji, he's like, you know what? Racing's a bit too hard at the moment. I'm going to be Sam Bennett's personal mechanic and try and fix his front wheel or disc. And he was spraying water into Sam Bennett's front wheel. What was going on there?
I don't know. Maybe the sound was annoying from like the disc wheel rubbing against his... against his bike, but anyway.
Cycling is ASMR for MVDP.
I think Van der Poel is just a bit bored throughout these types of races, like 20 kilometers, and basically not much happened so far. A pace on the Chipressa descent, and that's really it. So the man must be boring himself to death at that moment. So he was like, oh, I'm going to play a bit. And I think what came to mind on the Chipressa also played a lot into the latter part, because from that point onwards, because on the Chipressa, the Van der Poel positioning was already a bit meh, I was looking at the Poggio, like, he needs to be in the first 20 riders, well, perfectly in the first 10 or 8 or something on the Poggio, but top 20 is doable, I'd say, and like a good kilometer and a half or so before the Poggio started, he was in a position where I'm like, oh my God, he's in like 50th wheel. Like, if he doesn't move up now, he's not going to get to the front. Luckily,
and group two was coming back.
Yeah, exactly. The group with
making it bigger and harder to move up.
Yep. And that moment that the groups come together, allowed people to move on the right of the road to the front. Vanderpool was able to move on the right of the road to the front, and Caleb Ewan was brought by a teammate, I don't know which one, to the front for the team of Lotto Soudal. So those two are now in a good position. But we're moving near the Poggio now, and the washing machine effect starts happening again. And suddenly, just before they turn onto the Poggio, who do I see in 25th 30 wheel suddenly? Vanderpool. Somehow, the washing machine effect brought him way back again. And we've said it so many times, positioning is key on the Poggio, and positioning is the weakness of Vanderpool, in our opinion.
I think that was our concern
for you as well. Yeah.
We said it in the preview. That was our main concern. It wasn't, oh, if he's on Alaphilippe's wheel, can he follow Alaphilippe on the Poggio? Yeah, he will be able to. Will he be able to beat him in a sprint? Yeah, probably. But that's the race. Milano-San Remo is more than that, as we're about to see. Ganna came from nowhere, kept pulling for Ineos out of Group 2 as Luke Rowe pulled off, and Salvatore Puccio came to the front. Like, all the vets, Marcus Burkhardt for Bora Hansgrohe, every year I see him for like 3 minutes pulling in the last 15Ks of Milano-San Remo for the last like 5 years, I swear.
Yeah.
But as Benji said, like, Therese de Bont had brought MVDP up, and then those teams, Ganna just smacked it. And we're going to the Poggio now. All the groups are together. All the sprinters are pretty much here, except Gaviria, Viviani, and Bennett, who Demar, we just didn't see him after the Cipressa. We presume he got dropped on Poggio. Ganna comes to the front right before the Poggio right-hander, punches a hole through it and lines it out single file. He's got Van Baarle behind him, then Pidcock, Kwiatkowski. I didn't know who they were riding for, first of all. They didn't bring Hayter, who I was going crazy about on the preview, because he can climb and he can sprint. And, yeah, but Ineos were driving really hard pace, Benji, with Ganna. But it was for too long, I think, and no one attacked. And to contrast that to when people say, oh, well, why did X happen later on the Poggio and why was it maybe not effective? Last year, Trek and Fliegen attacks, Ciccone, Brambilla, Nibali. There's like a surge and then off the gas, surge and off the gas of the Poggio. Today, it was Ganna, big draft, steady. And I think that made a big difference, Benji. But, yeah, what happened in the Poggio probably from 8.5 to 6.5 Ks to go?
Well, we noticed that at a certain point, the riders from Ineos were kind of dipping out. They didn't have all their riders anymore, and somebody had to take over at the front. Pidcock was up there. We had Van Baarle still roughly there, and somebody had to make a move. I think they were just in the position where they, on the Poggio, they turned towards headwind for a bit, and then they turned back. And when they turned back is the moment where the attacks can happen. And this was that moment. They were moving on to the steepest section of the Poggio, which is still not a super steep climb. But the first one to make a move was Alaphilippe on the left side of the road for the viewers, right side for him. He was gassing it up. But the problem is, once again, that Van Aert was easily on his wheel.
Alaphilippe was opening a gap with Van Aert.
not really, because there was like a 5 meter gap after Van Aert.
True.
And then we saw in the background on the right of the picture, Van der Poel in like 15th position trying to move back rider by rider. And if you know that you're in that position, the moment that Alaphilippe is attacking, then it's going to be really tough to get to him and make a move yourself. So due to the positioning of Van der Poel at the start of the climb, he is now in a position where he needs to use all his energy to get back to the front of the group instead of just following. And I think that's the main issue we have with that positioning of Van der Poel, because not only did it really ruin his own position on this Poggio, not only did it ruin his opportunity to attack at that moment on the Poggio, it also allowed that every rider that he was passing had a bit of a bonus when it comes to the draft in his wheel. They could latch onto him a tiny bit and he could go.
Shockman.
Latch onto him and they could go. Shockman, exactly. And
I don't think he was making it. I retract what I said. Sharkman was trying to close Wout van Aert and Alaphilippe. Alaphilippe's attacked. Wout van Aert immediately goes, not attacks him, but just surges past him in the saddle. to keep the pace rolling because they're going to, he's happy to work with him. Hey, he won last year in the same scenario. And Shachman's on his own, flailing. MVDP tried to get a draft of him for a second. As Benji said, MVDP's moved up like close to 50 meter cap himself. And then MVDP's like, holy shit, I'm going to have to close this myself. And then Snap attacks across. And where, by the way, this is late in the Poggio. Like, this is after with a few hundred meters left.
Yeah.
And Alaphilippe really attacked in the last place he could because Ineos paced and no one attacked. Pidcock didn't attack. Kwiatkowski didn't attack. Van Baal was kind of left on the front and didn't really have the juice to pace. And so pretty much it all came back together. And we saw Caleb Ewan on the wheel of like Wout van Aert, second wheel after all these attacks coming to the crest of the Poggio. I've never been one of the craziest things I've ever seen, Benji.
The funniest thing about it is that the moment that we saw him in second wheel in the Ineos train a bit earlier and he was sitting there waiting for people to attack, he was almost with the Alaphilippe attack. He didn't really make it with them, but he was able to come back at the top as well. And the moment that the tempo went down in that front group just before the Poggio top, he was the rider that moved to the right front of the group and decided to try and launch a bit of an attack until he saw that somebody directly was there to get into his wheel. So not only was he there to try and just sprint from this group, he was like, YOLO, let me just do something myself on the Poggio. Honestly, never would have seen this coming. The way he was climbing in the last year had me blinded when it comes to his opportunities.
Toreno, mate.
And he was insane today. We can't say anything else.
He got dropped or was sick in Toreno on that sort of rolly stage. There's a few rolling climbs and he got dropped and we thought, oh, he must be unwell or something. Start it now. Caleb Ewan for polka dots. Someone take that Twitter account. It's the inverse of Nairo and Green. So I'll expect that to be done pretty shortly. But yeah, Caleb Ewan's right there. And I think that was a big problem for Wout van Aert and MVDP and Alaphilippe. Those three, I said in the preview, I think they're happy working together. They will pull, they'll close down attacks, they'll roll turns with each other, I think. But Caleb Ewan, even Wout van Aert and MVDP are like, oh, ooh, you are quick. And probably head-to-head, too quick for us. We need to get, I mean, I know Wout van Aert beat him in Toronto Stage 1, but yeah, Caleb Ewan is not someone you want to go to the Via Roma with. And that stultified the group. Every massive group at the top of the Poggio. No counters after MVDP had closed them. MVDP is still human after all. Like he can't counterattack after closing that attack. There's no gaps pretty much to this group of 10 or 11 riders that let me count out how many were in there. It was Pidcock, Alaphilippe, Ewan, MVDP, Wout van Aert, Sagan, Shachman, Colbrelli, Matthews, Aramburu, and Soren Kragh and Colbrelli. So a pretty big group, and they're being joined by other riders. Mohoric, Sturven are catching back on the descent because initially, Benji, by the way, Ineos haven't attacked, and like, Pidcock and Kwiatkowski, or Pidcock, Kwiatkowski didn't look like he had good wheels, good legs, but Pidcock trying on the descent, I don't know. I felt like they really needed Hayter, Benji. Like they were riding it as if they needed a sprinter.
Yeah, I feel like they were missing some, perhaps like a Moscon, because a Moscon would be the rider that is in this group and would be able to like make some crazy move just at the bottom to ruin a group like this. And if you're in a situation where there's a group like this going to the bottom of the Poggio, then you either need to make a difference on the descent, which is unlikely if your name isn't Mohoric, or you need to do something different where you try and launch an attack when the tempo goes down at the bottom. And I think that was the ideal play for the riders at that point that were in the group that were not necessarily the best sprinters. And where it was a bit of an all-or-nothing effect because Søren Kragh Andersen was in that group, for example. He's the kind of rider to make that move. And we went to the bottom. We saw that Some people were trying stuff in the descends. We saw that Pidcock was making that tiny move in the descent. He was pushing it on the descent. We saw that that didn't really work out because, well, at first it looked like the first five in that group were having a tiny bit of a gap on the rest, but you know that there's this effect when you come to the bottom that if the tempo at the bottom is not high enough, then it's all going to come together like an accordion. And yeah, if that happens and the group is back together, and it was just like that. And I don't remember who was the first one to attack at the bottom. Do you?
Sturven. Sturven attacked at the bottom, and he was pretty, he forecasted it. It came from the back, caught onto that group at the back. It's like the Cancellara attack when you don't want to go to the finish with Sagan. And yeah, Alaphilippe kind of blocked him, I think, as he was moving up the left-hand side as they are looking at it, right-hand side. Yeah, not deliberately. I'm just saying.
Before the Stuyven move, I think that there was another rider that was trying to make a move on the left side of the road, just when Pidcock went off the front. So Pidcock was at the front of the group, goes to the left, going off the front, then Alaphilippe was trying to attack on the left there. And because Pidcock went to the left,
he blocked
Alaphilippe. So perhaps he did it on purpose. Did he do it on purpose?
I thought Alaphilippe was thinking about attacking and then thought better of it. And
I don't think so. I think he was genuinely blocked by Pidcock.
Well, good. Well, we'll see. We'll have to review the tape and the overhead. But yeah, Sturven moves up on the left-hand side, attacks in the saddle, and gets a good gap. He knows he can't beat Ewan, Wout van Aert, and MVDP in a sprint, or is unlikely to. And he gets a good gap. Everyone's looking at each other. And this is the effect of Ewan in that group, Benji. And what we said in the preview, the problem for the big three winning this race it's like Gent Wevelgem all over again. If the group is large with not many people with teammates, it's impossible for them to control. Yes, they're so good, Wout van Aert, Alaphilippe, and MVDP, but they cannot close down every attack in the last 3 kilometers of Milano San Remo. They will lose, and they know that, especially if they have Caleb Ewan in their wheel. So that Ewan and the size of the group played a really big, I think, inhibiting factor on them closing those moves. Other riders tried to slip away. First, Matthews, he's looking under his shoulder. I know Matthews kind of tried to bridge, decided he wasn't going to do it, bailed out of it, and then it cost him in the sprint for the minor places. So that didn't really make sense. Ewan's still there. Obviously, Ewan has to surf the wheels. And then Soren Krah, Benji's favorite rider for DSM, counters with like 1,500 meters to go. He knows he can't win in a sprint. They're catching up. Well, he catches up to Sturven just under the Flamme Rouge. Sturven looks kind of gassed. I thought he was going to go out the back. Peter Sagan, who we thought was ill or coming back from COVID, always up there in MSR. He's now in this group. Shachtman's in the group too. It was Shachtman, Benji, who tried something to bridge across as well earlier. I remember you can see the head obble even from the helicopter shot on Via Roma. And that was it. We'll talk about that in a second. But yeah, he didn't pace for Sagan to bring it back. He tried to attack across. Maybe he didn't know Sagan was in that group. Soren Krah gets to Sturven. He goes past him, starts pacing. Sturven starts sitting on. You know they've got the left to right turns with 800 and 700 meters to go. Wout van Aert is on the front, and they're only like 125 meters behind Sturven and Soren Krah going into 650 meters to go. It couldn't have been more than 2-3 seconds. But we saw, even in the overhead, out of that last corner, Wout van Aert turned the head over the shoulder, didn't kick. Not his fault, but that's what happened. And that gap went out because Soren Krah was riding for second. He had Sturven on the wheel. I think he accepted he was riding for second out of that corner from 500, 600 to go. Still a good result to him in DSM. And no cohesion in the group behind. Soren Krah still pacing. Sturven in the wheel, in the wheel, in the wheel. Patient. The group is closing from behind. You can see it foreclosing the front end shot. MVDP starts launching from like 300 meters to go, desperately trying to get across to Sturven. in certain crafts. Sturvin starts sprinting at 125 meters. He can only get out of the saddle for about 3 or 4 seconds and just holds on with Caleb Ewan charging in his back wheel again. Second, Wout van Aert. Third. What a crazy and unexpected finish to this Milano Sanremo, Benji. I checked our YouTube comments of the preview before anyone could edit it. No one said the word Sturvin. So how surprised are you as a Belgian that he won?
I'm surprised that he won. I was not unaware of the scenario where a group would be at the bottom and a rider could launch away there was impossible. We've seen it also in Omloop. I feel like this reminds me completely of the Omloop victory of Valgren in 2018. A group that does not work together into the final kilometer, last minute attack, nobody responds, Valgren wins. Today, very similar, nobody responds, neutralized by the fact that, one, they don't necessarily have too many teammates, except for, I think, Schachmann and Sagan there. If those two did anything together, it might have been different, but I think they were done for. I think Sagan had a lot of trouble coming back in the descent, and Schachmann already tried to close the gap himself instead of pacing, so I don't think him pacing would have changed much. So in that group, I didn't expect too much cohesion. And with Ewan sitting there, I was at a kilometer to go. No, I think with a kilometer to go, the moment that he had the gap and Søren Kristensen was not attacking yet, that moment I knew he won because I didn't see anyone with a sprint able to close that gap where they would do so, because those riders will focus on their sprint. Those riders are not going to risk it before the sprint happens. Søren Kristensen is different. He needs to do this because he can't make it in the sprint. So Søren Krog gets the gap. He's not a sprinter, so people don't directly jump on his wheel. That's most likely a reason for that. Because if they know that, for example, Van Aert would respond to that, then everybody else would be in the wheel again.
And if you try and close him, you lose.
Yep.
If you are the rider and you don't have a teammate and you close Søren Krog in the last 1500, you lose. That's the dilemma and why almost the underrated riders who are willing to risk it for the biscuit. Not editing that out. In the last 3Ks, that's why you can get surprise winners of Milano Sanremo, because the big guns are all looking at each other. Even Pidcock, Wout van Aert was man-marking him, Benji, for a lot of the last 6 kilometers too. So crazy win by Sturvin. Here's the top 10. Sturvin, Ewan, third is Wout van Aert, fourth Sagan, fifth Van der Poel, Matthew sixth, Aaron Beru, seventh, the man, the myth, the legend. Cole Brayley, eighth. Søren Krog, ninth. Unlucky not to get on the podium. Turgis, 10th. Moric, 11th. Think of people with teammates. Got to say, Alfie finished 16th. Well, Schachmann was in that group, finished 14th. And Moric and Cole Brayley for Bahrain, 8th and 11th. But I'm not going to. I think Moric is the type of guy you might have expected trying to follow that sort of Krog move in the last few Ks. Maybe he was coming back to them on the descent and couldn't move up.
What I remember from Moric is, I think last year or the year before that, he was in that second group chasing the people that were at the front, and he was doing a lead out for a rider that was getting dropped off the back. So perhaps he's like, I'm not doing that again. And I'm not doing a lead out here for anybody. So, I was kind of surprised that Moric didn't try too much in the descent. He was trying to move forward just before it. And when everything exploded, he on the Poggio, he wasn't really there at the front. He tried to come back to the front. I think he was in the group, I think just behind the five that were trying the attacks on the descent. So Pidcock with the four riders in his wheel, then a tiny 10-meter gap and the rest of the group. I think he was there. I think the only people that weren't in the group was Sagan and someone else. I can't remember who. So I'm surprised that perhaps Moric didn't try anything in the descent. But, yeah, we can really expect that he must have been tired as well from the Poggio. So
yeah,
I don't blame him for it. I think that this race would have looked very different. I'm going to point at it again because I think that's the key part of this race. And it's not because I'm a hardcore Vanderpool fan, although I like how he wins. I think that if Vanderpool was in the top seven riders on the start of the Poggio and was in that position and didn't have to close all these gaps, he might have been able to do an actual attack on the Poggio and the race would have been different. And I think that would have changed a lot, because now he not only ruined the opportunity for that attack by being in a pretty shit position, but he also, yeah, he also brought a lot of people extra, a bit more towards the front on the Poggio. And those moves offered the chance for others to come back. So I think Van der Poel influenced the race a lot more than he thinks he does. I think in an interview past the race, Van der Poel said on Belgium TV, on VTM, he mentioned, I think I was in the right position on the Poggio. I don't think so. I love you, Mathieu, but I don't think so. I think that you need to be in the top 10 people there.
I'll believe the well for not.
I don't get it.
Like,
yeah.
The right position is on either of their wheel. I don't care which. And if you're not on their wheel on the Poggio, then you're not in the best sit. Like, what, he thinks being on Spiragli's wheel, 30 riders deep, eating wind on his right-hand shoulder, is the best position? I know it's just after the race, so but just that's just fundamentally not correct. Speaking of other quotes, Jasper Stuyven after the race said, in the last kilometre, I tried to recover a little bit before the final bend ahead of the finish. I managed to recover a little, insert brackets from me, thanks to certain crans and pacing, and then I launched the sprint. I still cannot believe I've won Milano Sanremo. After the Poggio descent, I saw there were still some sprinters, so I tried to go all in and anticipate the sprint. It was not a strategy I decided on this morning, but rather my instinct. It's amazing. I cannot find the words. What a great win for him. Pedersen at Kerner, and then him at MSR. Crazy. Trek just keep winning.
Yep, we spoke a lot. Yep, we spoke a lot about Van der Poel's positioning now, but I also want to highlight the fact that he was the first rider after the line to directly after the line say congratulations to Stuyven. Yeah. So I really like the person that Van der Poel is. Directly cut away the loss. We lost, but this dude, congratulations, man. And I like that. I really like that. So awesome work.
I think Jumbo-Visma did a pretty good job today, to be honest. I'm glad that Wout van Aert didn't just ride everyone to the line and do a lead out for Caleb Ewan. I think I'm glad he didn't do that. I'm glad he still got third and rode for himself. I know people say, well, you can't win the race that way, but if he closed down Stuyven on his own and gave Ewan a lead out, he literally has no chance of winning. So they pretty much just had to hope to sprint out of that last corner and beat Ewan and catch Stuyven. I think the question marks, I mean, big win for Ewan. I doubted him massively. I think I said on the Stanley Street Social podcast during the Aussie Nationals that I was like, nah, no way Ewan can win Milano Sanremo. Well, he clearly can, the way he was climbing today, and a 50 metres longer, and he would have won the sprint. Just ahead of Wout van Aert and one Milano Sanremo. So maybe just keeps the climbing legs for one day of the year. I think the big question marks strategy-wise is Ineos Benji, team selection and the strategy on the Poggio. Now, maybe Pidcock was supposed to launch with 7Ks to go and just didn't feel it, but, yeah, I don't really know what their plan was. Can you elucidate what you think their plan was in the last 10Ks?
Who? Sorry?
Ineos.
I don't know. I think that the attack of Pidcock was not the most ideal one, the one in the descent. I don't know what he was attempting there.
But surely that wasn't the plan. A weird
move.
That can't have been their plan. Can't
have been the plan. I think that Pietkowski, after the crash of a few weeks ago, I wasn't really looking at him at any point in this race for the leadership of Ineos, so I was mainly looking at Pidcock, and I think that I think that he needed to get away with a smaller group, and I don't think they were prepared for the fact that someone like Caleb Ewan would be in the group. But then again, you should be, because Wout van Aert is almost as good of a sprinter, so yeah, it's really hard to say what Ineos was trying. I think they made it hard on the Chipresa to make sure nobody attacked there. On the Poggio, they made it hard at the start to make sure somebody could make a move there. They tried to follow those attacks. they were with them at the top. But then they're in a position where the only point they can attack is really after the descent, because you're not going to make the big difference in the descent itself. That's just a waste of energy, I think. And I think Pidcock wasted energy there. When it comes to the bottom, yeah, you see the attack of Stuyven. You see that Pidcock is willing to respond to that, but he responds to it too late. And no, it was Kwiatkowski that was the first to respond to Stuyven, actually. Pidcock tried earlier. So, yeah, I have no clue what they were. Yeah, I think their tactics just failed on them at that moment. I think it's also not easy to say what we're going to do here. It's a lot of riders riding on instinct just at the bottom of that climb, because the situation was perhaps not really the most likely one to happen. And I would not know what I would decide in that moment. I would not know what I would do. It depends on which kind of rider I would be, obviously. But if I was a Pidcock, then he has a bit of a sprint, but he's never going to make it in a sprint against Caleb Ewan and Van Aert, I'd say. So he needs to attack, which he tried a bit in the descent and then just after it, but it went nowhere. So I think it just didn't go their way today. I think there's not too much else to add. They don't have the riders to win a sprint, so they have to do it differently, and the differently didn't work for them.
Yeah, they needed peak Kwiatkowski, and he doesn't seem to be quite on that form at the moment. All they need is someone like Ian Stannard to, you know, make it over and counter or attack.
That's a big, that's a big if.
Nah, Ian Stannard goated. I won't hear a word against him. him against Chavanel on Poggio, best ever. But anyway, that's a moment of the past. Milano Sanremo, bright today. It's been terrible weather before when Chiolek and Christoph won, I think, and lovely conditions, albeit, I think, a bit chilly today. Just a great race, and I love the last 30 kilometers enthralling. You can go on back and watch it again and pick out so many different moments that changed this race despite them. I think they rode for under 7 hours, 6.5 hours today. But we hope you enjoyed this recap. We got a lot of positive feedback on the preview show. It's one of our best performing podcasts ever. So given that, we'll keep rolling out the previews for the one day for the monuments. We've got Trofeo Binda tomorrow, Women's World Tour race. So we'll have coverage of that. I think that's being broadcast on GCN, I assume, and other places.
Yes.
So you can watch that. It's the only major racing on tomorrow. Then we've got Catalunya on Monday. I got the highlights on my channel, and then we'll have potty recaps every single stage. So busy week and a bit coming up right now. Any last thoughts, Benji?
No, it's not really the winner we expected, but it's the winner we deserve.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad it was a different winner, though. It keeps cycling interesting, to me at least. That's all from us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.